Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, Free Markets, the GDI series. This week, we meet the world's greatest specialist in low-cost private schools. Huh? You think that's an oxymoron? Think again. James Tooley, professor at Newcastle University in the UK, will explain that there are not just hundreds, but in fact, thousands of low-cost private schools around the world. Where are they? Well, they're not on the famous campuses. They're in the slums and the suburbs of cities in poor countries, Asia, Latin America, Africa, and it's a grassroots movement. The parents there want their kids to get a good education, and they just don't trust the existing system. James Tooley will also tell us about a dramatic moment in his career in India when he refused to pay a bribe, was unceremoniously thrown into jail, and might still be there yet if he hadn't found a way out. Here he is. Professor Tooley, we're going to talk about a fascinating phenomenon that you are the perhaps the world's greatest expert on, which is schools, grassroots initiatives, schools for people who need them in poor countries and who decide to create them. And it's a fascinating topic. We're going to get to it just in a couple of seconds. But first, I must tell the audience, we'll also talk about your incredibly horrific sojourn in a prison in the middle of India for completely unjustified reasons and how you survived that with great dignity. So we'll get to that. But first, let's talk about the schools. You point out that in many poor countries, for us, private schools signifies privilege, money, luxury, and so forth in the ruling class. But in poorer countries, since many times the public schools are terrible or non-existent, more and more people are creating them, whether it's Latin America, Asia, Africa. And you say if you drive through the suburbs of Nairobi or Montevideo or Rio or Hong Kong or wherever, you'll see them. You'll learn to discern them in the landscape. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it is an extraordinary phenomenon. I call them low-cost private schools.
Yeah.
And these are private schools that are in the slums and the poor areas and low-income areas of all the countries across sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Central America, Latin America. And they are, as you say, they're poor people, ordinary people, are fed up with the quality of government schools where teachers don't turn up, and if they do turn up, they don't teach. Mm-hmm. This is a well-known phenomenon now. And instead of sort of acquiescing in that mediocrity, poor people themselves, entrepreneurs within those communities, have set up these low-cost private schools. And they're not just, you know, it's not one or two of them. As you say, you can drive down into the slums, poor areas, you'll see them on every street corner. And the facts of them, I mean, around 70% of urban kids are attending these low-cost private schools. In rural areas, it might be 30%, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's a big phenomenon. There's hundreds of thousands of them. In India, there might be 450,000 of these low-cost private schools. In Lagos State in Nigeria, there are 14,000. And I've been, I stumbled across them myself 18 years ago in Hyderabad. We'll talk about Hyderabad, I know, later. But I stumbled across them in Hyderabad. Well, I went into the slums. Actually, I was there in Hyderabad because I was doing some work on high-end private schools. I was an expert on private schools. I was doing work on elite private schools for the International Finance Corporation. But that didn't satisfy me. My life should be about serving the poor. That's what I thought it should be about. I was an expert on private education. How did these two mix? I went into the slums and I found these low-cost private schools. I found one, then another, and soon I was in contact with 500 in a federation of these schools, and I suddenly realized I could be an expert on private education and be serving the poor at the same time. So it's been an incredible journey over this last 18 years, but I've been championing these schools wherever I go. And it's really a phenomenon that's worth noting and worth remarking.
And in huge numbers, as you've just quoted.
Yeah, exactly.
And what struck me as well is this is not a concept, an idea, some do-gooder somewhere dreamt it up and wrote it down at the World Bank or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not that at all.
Yeah.
This is real grassroots. They didn't ask permission from anybody to do this.
No.
They did it the way our pioneer ancestors out west on the prairie did it. They would have these country schools, which might be in a home. So how did it grow to be so big without anybody noticing?
Yes, I mean, that's a really important question. When I first you know, I discovered them for myself and, as it were, for the West, in a sense. Mm. But obviously they were there before that, and they were off everyone's radars. And why were they off radars? Probably for two or three reasons. One was that typically people from aid agencies don't go to these very poor places. You know, typically people from aid agencies might stay in a plush hotel in the middle of town. They meet with the government officials who take them where they want them to go. And so they don't, like me, just go wandering off into the slums to see what is actually there. That's mm-hmm. the first thing. And I don't mean to demean these people, but there is this temptation. It can be quite frightening just to go wandering in the slums and see what you find, you know. Yeah. It can be quite disturbing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, now governments may have had an inkling something was going on in some cases, and they, or even some aid agencies, and they were appalled by the idea of the poor doing something for themselves. Because, uh-huh. you know, ever since the, you know, what was it, the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights, we've known that education must be done by governments, supplemented mm-hmm. by international agencies where required. You've got to have free, compulsory public education, you know, government education. And if the poor are doing it for themselves, this is somewhat disturbing to that sort of mentality, isn't it? And the fact is, these schools have been there for many years. They are growing in numbers. And now, because of my work and my team's work, people are recognizing these schools are important. They can't be ignored. Still, some people want to close them down.
Yeah.
Still, some people are fighting the implications of them. But by and large, people recognize at least they exist, and they're doing an important job now.
And you mentioned, you say at some point in the Bible of these things, there's supposed to be free education provided by government. Mm. But you also point out it's not even free. The supposedly free government-oriented schools have all kinds of charges, you know, for supplies and for all kinds of things. So there's not even that advantage.
Yeah, that's a very important point. So we've done lots of household surveys and discovered exactly what you've said. So if you look at the fees alone, private schools, yes, they will have higher fees than the government schools. Mm-hmm. And government schools typically aren't totally free. There are some informal levies, sometimes some illegal levies that are there. But yes, the fees in the private schools are higher. But then to go to school, you've got to have shoes, you've got to have uniform, you've got to buy transportation, you've got to have books and all these other things. And if you add all those together, we found in our studies that the cost for a parent of sending a child to a government school is 75% of the cost of sending to a low-cost private school. So it's more in the private school, but it's not, you know, it's in roughly in the same sort of ballpark, isn't it? So these schools, so I mean, they're serving the majority of the poor. Studies show they are outperforming the government schools. Children in the low-cost private schools, even after doing all the proper statistical tests and so on, they outperform the children in the government schools. Mm. They're affordable. They're not much more expensive than the government schools. They're affordable for even those on the poverty line. And for me, the extraordinary thing is, there's so many of them, they're sustainable. They are sustainable and therefore scalable. So in a sense, they're the holy grail of development in education, a sustainable, scalable solution that's provided by the poor communities themselves at a price affordable for most. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. It's been my privilege to have sort of found these schools and then to be able to talk about them on channels like this. It's an extraordinary success story.
And in my mind's eye, I can just see some bureaucrat with a pad going in there and saying, well, this isn't the curriculum, and where are the reading scores, and why aren't you doing this, where are the diplomas for your teachers? I mean, all kinds of objections can be put up to slow this down, but it's so grassroots. It seems irrepressible.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. The bureaucrats, the inspectors go in with that list, that checklist, as mm-hmm. it were, and these schools don't satisfy a couple of the important ones, important to the bureaucrats.
Yeah.
Typically, if you're a low-cost private school in the slums, you don't have a one-acre playing field or a large playing field.
No.
You know? And you try and buy one of those in the slums. Try and find one, let alone mm-hmm. buy one, you know. And typically, the teachers in these low-cost private schools are not as qualified, as certified, as the teachers in the government schools. They're not.
They're almost volunteers.
No, they're not volunteers, but they're typically young people who are from those communities themselves, who are obviously more advanced than the kids they're teaching, but somehow they don't have the social distance from the kids they're teaching. Mm-hmm. And they're not as well paid as in the government schools, they're not as well certified, but they do better. And one of the reasons they do better is, a fisherman father told me this story, and he's absolutely right. He lived next to the government school in his village. He saw how the teachers arrived, always arrived late, always left early, and got the kids doing chores. And he sent his daughter to one of these low-cost private schools, and he said, if you don't turn up in the private school, if you're a teacher and you don't turn up, you'll be fired and replaced. In the government schools.
That's pretty telling.
It's pretty, you know, and it sounds hard, but that's the, you know, that's the what you need if you're a parent. You want your teacher to be there. In the government schools, if the teachers aren't there, they're not fired. They can't be fired. One senior official told me no one can remove a teacher in a government school, not even except for God. Except for God, he said. And then he said, not even God.
It's patronage.
Yeah.
These are jobs that are given.
Yeah, you've got jobs for life. And so you've got no accountability.
Which begs another question, because a lot of these countries have authoritarian governments, not real democratic governments. You were teaching mathematics in Zimbabwe in the days of Mugabe.
Yeah.
So the bureaucrat would also say, where's the picture of our dictator who's supposed to be in every classroom?
Yeah.
And the dictator, if you do a slight thing that he doesn't like, may shut you down. I mean, it's very hard to do any of this grassroots stuff when you've got that kind of authoritarian regime.
Yeah, I mean, the low-cost private schools, I mean, they tend to follow that sort of rule, you know, have the picture of the prime minister, the president, or whatever on the wall. You know, those things that are not impossible to satisfy, they tend to do, just because, you know, let's not get ourselves into trouble that we can avoid. And typically, they will follow the national curriculum if that's required. It's the only show in town. The parents want that. Where these schools, I mean, where they can innovate, they can bring in extra English and mathematics as sort of core subjects, they can teach in ways they like. But really, their key sort of selling point for you and me really is that they are serving the poor, they're in the neighborhoods of the poor, they're close to the homes of low-income communities, they're fair to girls, they do all the things that we will want to see from a lot of schools, and they outperform the government schools at an affordable price. You know, there's nothing really to fault here, unless you're rigidly stuck in that ideology that says education must be provided by government, and it must be free at the point of delivery. Unless you're stuck in that sort of mentality, there's nothing to dislike about these schools.
And it's easy to, that mentality is easy to disguise as a lofty ideal, but it's not.
Yeah.
And these schools are so good, they're doing the job, they must overflow. They must have too many requests for students or teachers.
Well, you get a lot of these schools. This is the point. You know, those of us who think markets can solve problems are very, very aware that there's so many of these schools competing with each other. You know, you can go down one alleyway in a slum and there'll be four or five of these schools down the same alleyway. And so the individual schools might not be full, but they are, that because they're competing with each other, it's quite tight, their margins. But they do have, children do want to go to them. You've got this phenomenon in India in particular now, where this sounds incredible, it's true. Thousands of schools in India now are empty of students.
Public schools.
Public schools. Or got a tiny number of students because the students have left en masse to go to the private schools. And because there's no accountability in the government, the public schools, they can still stay with their full teacher complement, still getting paid, and the kids have left. The kids have voted with their feet.
But a clever government, and this may happen one day, would take advantage and say, okay, good, they're taking this burden off our shoulders, more power to them. But I guess we're not there yet.
Well, that's been one of the ways I've tried to sell these schools to government. I mean, we did some very thorough surveys in Lagos State in Nigeria. It's one of the most studied states in this whole area. And that's what I was able to say. Before I started that work, it was actually 15 years ago in Lagos in Nigeria, the government and the World Bank, everyone believed out-of-school children were 30 or 40%. And they And when we started going into these areas, you thought, well, that's not true. The children who the government and the international agencies, they think they're out of school, they're actually in these low-cost private schools, which are unregistered. And by the time we throw in all those kids who are in these unregistered private schools, the out-of-school number is not 30 or 40%, it's 5%. And so, you know, one can, you know, I've had meetings with the government saying, look, you're doing an amazing thing here. You could call this a public-private partnership, call it what you like, but you've solved the problem of out-of-school children. You've got all these private schools, these entrepreneurs who've created these schools, and the children are not out of school. The same in South Sudan. I was there doing a similar study in South Sudan, and before our work, they thought 50% of the kids in Juba and its environs were out of school. We were able to show it's as low as 20, 25%. So you can sell it to government and saying, look, there's an incredible success story, but still many are ideological. Many of my academic colleagues and those in the international agencies are still ideological, and they will still try and condemn these schools. I don't get it. I don't get what they don't like.
Well, it's like any new idea, and bureaucrats will hang on to the old ideas longer than anyone.
Yeah, bureaucrats and academics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And worse than the bureaucrat, of course, is the functionary in the middle of India who will throw you into jail for no reason, for a bribe, and you will have to spend days and days there living in excrement and no food and no cover for against the cold. Anyway, let's get to this because it's incredible what happened.
And I don't want to dwell on it because it was, you know, in terms of my life, it's sort of passed and moved on. I would not regret having had this experience, but what it was, you're right, there was a senior police superintendent who, in Hyderabad. In Hyderabad, south central India, where I'd started my work. And as an actual fact, I'd gone and done literacy classes in one of these prisons in Hyderabad when I first came there.
As an alumnus?
I went back.
A connoisseur.
But there were several things about this. I got to see that horrible underbelly of corruption in a state. Now, Hyderabad is known as a sophisticated Indian city. It's not one of these backward Indian cities. And yet, even there, the police were incredibly corrupt. I was able to see the corruption of the judicial system and the prison system itself. And so I was able to do that.
I want to set it up because for the viewer, we don't want to lose our viewer. It's an incredibly dramatic story. This is a woman who pretended to be your friend, and very subtly at some point she asks for a bribe, but it's not clear that she's doing that because she does it too subtly.
Yes.
However, 3 days later, her thugs show up.
Oh, no, the same night.
Oh, the same night. And they throw you into this cell.
Throw me into
And
prison.
It's Kafkaesque. You have no way out. The British government won't help you. This is the situation you were in, and there's piles of SHIT.
So I arrive there. I arrive in the cell. It's 6 p.m. at night. If you want to know the sort of details, I arrive there. She's taken me before a friendly judge, friendly to her, that is, to get me consigned into prison. I arrive in the cell, 6 p.m. at night, and the cell is completely empty, apart from three piles of excrement, as you point out. Nothing else, there's no furniture, nothing else. And I'm there just in roughly what I'm wearing now, because she had said, don't worry about it. She was trying to be friendly. Don't be worried about it. Everything's provided there. So I looked over across the corridor, and the Indian prisoners gathered round to see this foreigner here. And I said, so when is food? I'm a little bit hungry. And they said, food was 3 hours ago. There's no food now till tomorrow. Fine. I'm a little bit thirsty. I said, when is water coming? And they said, water was 3 hours ago. No water now till tomorrow. I said, I'm a little bit chilly, you know, it's quite cold in a March evening in Hyderabad. When do they bring blankets, I said. And they said, well, you should bring your own blankets. And so I sort of tried to internalize all that, wandered around my cell, tried to remember all the ways of surviving in this environment. And then 10 minutes later, they called me, the other Indian prisoners, and amongst themselves, and they didn't have to do this. And this is why this experience will live with me forever. I'll never regret having this experience. Amongst themselves, they'd clicked together a blanket, bread, butter, jam, apples, orange, and banana amongst themselves.
And a bottle of water.
And they called the jailer. Again, at risk to themselves, the jailer could have been brutal to them for doing this, but at risk to themselves, they called the jailer, who then was fortunately a friendly guy that night, and transferred it across to me. I mean, you know, this was not the Shawshank Redemption. This was people caring for each other, and for the rest of the time, they looked after me, I looked after them. The jailers were brutal, typically one of their delights was beating people up in front of me. They wouldn't touch me, but they would beat people up in front of me to show their power and my powerlessness. But I saw the worst of humanity. I saw the most beautiful things of humanity. The other prisoners where they cared for me, even though many of them were these under trials who are there sometimes for years.
Waiting.
Waiting not trial, but waiting for a charge, pre-charge. And why are they waiting? Because they can't afford to go to court, because court is expensive. You might need to spend $1,000 to get to court. And therefore, they're just stuck there.
And meanwhile, the British government had the gall to tell you, if we pay the bribe, because she was asking for a bribe to reimburse another bribe, the police commissioner, yeah. If we pay her the bribe, you'll be in worse trouble.
Yeah.
So
well,
therefore,
it's
good luck.
Because we have the Bribery Act in England. So when I got out of prison and was able to contact the British High Commission, they say, we can't do anything. We can't do anything at all. So she was after a $25,000 bribe from me to give me back my passport and let me go. And that was the money she had paid to get her position. You know, so the corruption's all the way through. And the British High Commission, they were very friendly to me. They said, you know, if you're physically harmed, you know, then we'll come to us again. Mentally harmed didn't seem to bother them. You know, obviously I was mentally...
It's incredible, boy.
But then they did remind me that if I did pay the bribe, then because of the Bribery Act, they'd arrest me on my return at Heathrow Airport.
You incredible.
Know? So it was...
It's incredible. It's Kafkaesque at both ends.
Yeah,
And the you've lived in Hyderabad since then, now on and off, I think?
No, I'm asking
is, did you ever see her again?
I've been back to Hyderabad a couple of times, but now I wrote a book about it. I wrote a sort of memoir, which was really catharsis, getting off my chest. Everyone was anonymous, but perhaps... easily identified. I'm not going to go back to Hyderabad again for a bit. I go back to India frequently. Mm-hmm. The good news about India is it's a federal system. So the police force is different elsewhere. I feel safe enough elsewhere.
But you never ran into her again?
I don't want to. No
obviously.
No.
Yeah. But you picked up where you had left off and continued your work. There's a great deal of sense of honor in there.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, for a while I couldn't travel. I mean, I'm at the University of Newcastle, and not unfairly, the Newcastle University insurers said, Tooley is not traveling for a bit now, you know, he's too much of a liability. So this did lead to something else interesting in my life. Because I couldn't travel, and I am just a one-trick pony. I am a one-trick pony who's obsessed with these low-cost private schools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what can I do in England? There's no low-cost private schools there. So I went onto the streets in the poorer parts of Newcastle with my clipboard, asking people, would there be any interest and any demand in low-cost private schools in England? And to my surprise, I found a lot of people were very interested in this idea.
Incredible.
And so... after a while, I got together with a couple of other buddies who'd been involved in private education, high-end private education, convinced them of this idea of a low-cost school. And in September, a couple of months ago, we opened our first low-cost private school in England. It took us 485 days to get permission from government.
Yeah.
The unions have been picketing all our
meetings.
Yes,
the teachers' unions don't like you anywhere.
No.
Because you're an enemy in a way.
Yes.
Because you speak for freedom and freedom of action.
Yes, yeah. The teacher unions have been picketing us, and we've got now a small number of parents have crossed the line, as it were, to come and join us. I see this as a very important thing, because our fees are much lower than the mm-hmm. per capita funding in the state schools. That's why the unions are bothered about us, because the unions talk all the time about the public schools
Fairness.
Being underfunded.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is actually you don't need fancy buildings. You need good teachers, you need good curriculum, and you need, you know, people who are really on your side, the education side, not other things. Anyway, watch this space. You know, I'm not saying if that works and it works.
So this will be your pilot project.
This is the pilot. We've got one school. If it works, we'll have 5 to 10 schools. I've created chains of schools in other parts of the world. It is my passion. It's my passion to see how you can improve education. I've been in the rest of the world for some of the poorest people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to now see how private education works, not for the poorest in England yet, but certainly for those who can't afford private education. I want to see how that works, really.
Well, Professor Tooley, if I get a chance to go out to Newcastle, I certainly will. I'll pay you a visit. Yeah. But I ain't never going to Hyderabad for nothing, not even a vacation. So long life and good luck.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure meeting you.